Okay, this is session 13, August 15th, 2006, side one. And we're in the LaRouche section after doing McLuhan for a couple of weeks. We're now on page 22, which we reached the top of a few weeks ago. And now we're going to continue on 22 with a long quote from LaRouche. Goes on and covers most of page 24 also. And it's from The Secrets Known Only to the Inner Elites, LaRouche's magazine called The Campaigner, the May-June 1978 issue. So Scott's going to read the quote. This is long. It's about the Platonic method, his view of Plato's form of knowledge.
The Platonic method rightly distinguishes three qualities of knowledge, mental levels among people. The first, lowest condition of the human mind is the level of simple belief. Belief premised on popular mythologies and prejudices and on a state of ignorance concerning individual experience, otherwise known as, quote, common sense. The second, next higher level of knowledge is equivalent to the condition of understanding, and that's italicized.
In quotes, or in italics, and simple belief was in italics in the first paragraph.
Yeah, the second next higher level of knowledge is equivalent to the condition of understanding defined by Immanuel Kant, this is in italics, the mere understanding. Persons at this level have consistent knowledge of the ostensibly lawful features of practice in certain various categories of human practice in general. This is a condition corresponding to the lowest level of what may be termed scientific knowledge. Such persons do not know why, and that's italicized, such categories exist, or how or why the ostensibly lawful principles appropriate to such categories are determined. They have merely practical knowledge of consistent cause and effect features of practice in those categories of experience in which they have been educated. The third highest level of human knowledge is reason, and that's italicized. The word reason, otherwise termed Plato's Socratic reason. It is only on this level that truth can be efficiently comprehended. The knowledge of the two lower levels is necessarily mythological, false, or as Spinoza specifies, quote, fictitious. For such reasons, the Platonics judged mythologies twofoldly. All mythologies they knew to be inherently false, or in parentheses, fictitious, and this next phrase is italicized, but no person could rise above mythologies except by attaining reason. Therefore, in dealing with masses living at the inferior levels of mental life, it was deemed necessary to deal with them on the terms of mythological beliefs. The issue of practical politics, therefore, took the task-oriented form of distinguishing among destructive and useful mythologies. Those forms of simple beliefs or mere understanding which tended to allow society to move in directions otherwise required by reason were deemed the tolerable class of mythologies. Those other mythologies which tended towards evil consequences were evil beliefs which must be fought accordingly.
Now over to page 24. Since McLuhan is on page 23.
It is impossible to understand the central doctrinal issues among leading Christian theologians from the apostolic period to the present times without taking that Platonic view conclusively into account. These theologians have been concerned, and this two words are italicized, for themselves, and for determination of policy with the issues of truth according to reason. They have been, at the same time, otherwise concerned with popular mythologies, respecting chiefly whether this or that popular belief led away from or toward the realization of the dictates of reason. Although the objective has been to bring all mankind into the state of reason, and then italicized and in parentheses, he's equating reason with atonement here. For immediate purposes, the rule has been set that this effort must be situated within terms of the problem defined by the simple beliefs of the ignorant. The Aristotelians and their heirs, noticeably including Bernard of Clairvaux,
who started the Knights Templar, according to mythology or history,
Martin Luther, and the Presbyterian leaders, had and continue an opposite policy concerning mythologies. The original Aristotelians were the intelligence services arm of the oligarchies jointly controlling the court of Philip of Macedon and the contemporary Persian court of that time. Their objectives were to stop technological and scientific progress and to create zero-growth synthetic mythologies as the simple beliefs of the ignorant masses. These efforts they regarded as the means to establish permanent world rule by a landlord-based oligarchy, de-emphasizing cities in favor of countryside and maintaining, quote, Malthusian, zero-growth, anti-technology policies against scientific progress. They have not altered that method or purpose to the present day. Coming down the last paragraph, the innermost belief of the leading Christian theologians with access to reason is typified by the outlook of the famous Abelard of the 11th century A.D., where strict Aristotelian...
Okay, end of period, and then new sentence.
Yeah, A.D., period. Where strict Aristotelians argued that God made himself impotent by recreating... by creating inalterable laws for the universe, and hence only omniscient, Abelard... And hence, only omniscient Abelard defined the function of man's existence according to reason to be the helper of God in the continuing work of creation.
Let's read that sentence again.
Starting from...
Yeah, where strict Aristotelians argued that God made himself impotent by creating inalterable laws for the universe and hence only omniscient, Abelard defined the function of man's existence according to reason to be the helper of God in the continuing work of creation.
Abelard located lawfulness in the lawfulness governing the order of continued creation. The exact opposite position was classically argued by the 12th century Bernard of Clairvaux as a point of importance we shall cover in the course of this report.
Okay, so is this the first time you've looked through this quote? Have you thought about it?
No, it's not the first time I've looked at it. And I could lead with a question or two, if you want. Let's see, as I scan down the page from the beginning of the quote, he's laying out simple belief and then understanding.
Mere understanding, yeah.
Mere understanding. And the highest level of knowledge is reason. And here he says the knowledge of the two lower levels is necessary. The two lower levels, that would be simple belief or which he relates to. See, he equates simple belief with common sense.
Yeah.
As one of these two lower levels, necessarily mythological or false, as Spinoza specifies, quote, fictitious. And I tend to disagree with that because I see common sense as being derived from practical experience and not necessarily false or fictitious.
Right, and that is LaRouche's point, that the Aristotelian method reinforces that common sense, which McLuhan develops into, you know, his new Aristotelian knowledge, and LaRouche is the opposite here. He says, no, knowledge based on the senses is looking at the glass darkly, through the mirror darkly, that to get new breakthroughs you have to go beyond what seems to be evident, because always subsequent knowledge surprises, real breakthroughs surprise people, and their sensory, the evidence of the senses belied or would not have pointed to that new technology. So he's saying the problem with empirical positivist Aristotelian derivative knowledge is too embedded in the practical and the common sense. And that was Arush's criticism of those who criticized him for being idealistic. He said, no, I'm practical, because we're not going to get out of this situation unless we look beyond what seems to be obviously practical. The common sense practicality will lead to disaster. So that's the probe he's making on your assumption that the common sense is where we get reality. We get reality from the common sense. It's best to be practical. Arush says, no, don't be practical, but it's not a flighty practicalness. It's based on how to think clearly about the implications of the technology you have now and where it will go.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, anything else?
Down here he's saying, for such reasons the Platonics judged mythologies too foldly. All mythologies they knew to be inherently false or fictitious, but no person could rise above mythologies except by attaining reason. Therefore, in dealing with masses living at inferior levels of mental life, it was deemed necessary to deal with them on terms of mythological beliefs. The issue of practical politics, therefore, took the task-oriented form of distinguishing among destructive and useful mythologies. So, I don't know, I thought maybe it'd be interesting just to contrast here his idea of practical politics with McLuhan's definition of modern politics, which he sees as, you know, modern politics as being show business. So was that, you know...
The way to look at this is that LaRouche is including what McLuhan would call the rhetorical method of putting on the public. You look at where your audience is at, what their belief system is, you put on an expertise in that knowledge, and then correct it. In other words, you begin with the person's ignorance, and you work with that knowledge, or in quotes, knowledge, and then you point to something higher, different, or point out the fallacious nature, the fictitious nature of that knowledge or mythology. The thing is, you're always dealing with people who haven't attained a way to think platonically, so you have to work with the mythologies that exist. For example, Augustine and the patristic fathers, the church, Christian church fathers, became experts in pagan knowledge, in pagan mythologies, and they could argue with the other pagan guys on their terms, but they didn't do it to promote the pagan knowledge. They had to be good in the enemy's ways of thinking, which reflected the masses that they manipulated with their pagan mythologies, and they would work with that expertise and then point to some other meaning beyond the pagan meaning.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the technique of practical politics. Become an expert in what the people believe, put on, and then talk in those terms.
Mm-hmm.
So when I talked to LaRouche years ago, he told me that that he pretended he was into Marx and wrote a lot about Marx in the late 60s, early 70s, because the SDS and the student radicals were into Marx. So he already had an expertise in Marx, but he hoiked it up. But he could drop it at any point when the audience, his targeted audience, which were students, weren't into Marx anymore. And he did shift in the mid-70s to another view. He basically, in simple terms, started talking about oligarchs and conspiracy, in quotes,
mm-hmm.
idea. He didn't use the Marxist thinking anymore, because nobody was cognizant of Marxist stuff by the middle 70s and late 70s.
Mm-hmm.
So he would adapt. If you read what he said about Marx, he had the same program within Marxist thinking, and he would critique all the other Marxists and lefts and socialist party people. The same critique he applied later in the so-called right-wing posture he took.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same view that technology is the saving grace of human development, and that there's a certain way to do it. So he's saying here, this is what you did, and he's talking about the Christian people, the Christian fathers did this. In other words, they didn't necessarily believe. If you go to the next page, top of 24, he says, It is impossible to understand the central doctrinal issues among leading Christian theologians from the apostolic period, apostle period, to present times without taking that Platonic view inclusively into account. In other words, that they put on the mythologies and that they directed people in one direction, one mythology, which would be to live upright in moderation and the Ten Commandments, than rather advocating Dionysian pagan hedonistic mythologies.
Mm-hmm.
They're both mythologies. In other words, to get the person to have a conscience and have morality is a kind of mythology. Mm-hmm. Because a person of reason would not operate under fear with that mythology of trying to be a moral person. They would understand it technically and say more comprehensively, that's the only way to go. It's the only way to think. Wouldn't be under... See, you're directing people who need direction. So you favor mythology, which keeps them on the straight and narrow, so to speak, back then, rather than one that was disruptive to the social order.
Mm-hmm.
So he says, these theologians have been concerned for themselves and for determination of policy with the issues of truth according to reason. Read that again. These theologians have been concerned for themselves and for determination of policy with the issues of truth according to reason. They have been at the same time otherwise concerned with popular mythology. All right, so he's saying these theologians have been concerned for themselves. They're on the third level. They knew they had to live by reason, personally, for their own sanity. These theologians have been concerned, and in italics, for themselves and for determination of policy with the issues of truth according to reason. But they have been at the same time otherwise concerned with popular mythologies, respecting chiefly whether this or that popular belief led away from or toward the realization of the dictates of reason. Although the objective has been to bring all of mankind into the state of reason atonement, for immediate purposes, the rule has been that this effort must be situated within terms of the problem defined by the simple beliefs of the ignorant. You got to deal with where the audience is at.
Yeah. I think that people within organizations tend to enter into the process of reasoning in a way that is biased towards their own agendas.
Right, and LaRouche felt that there was a universal agenda that was not subject to your bias.
Mm-hmm.
When you reach the level of reason, in italics, the hypothesis of the higher hypothesis, we'll find out. Did we already do that? Maybe it's coming up. If we go back, I think it's going to develop that. There's the simple hypothesis, then there's the higher hypothesis, and the third level is the hypothesis of the higher hypothesis, where you see the pattern that leads to higher hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely is putting, it's early elitist management. You know, they have a sense of being an elite, and they look down on the ignorant, they consider them ignorant, and they try to massage them.
Right. Yeah.
You have to speak in their language.
Yeah, and that's the rub, that once they take on the arrogance of feeling like they're superior beings, ultimately that leads to, you know, a Hitler.
Right, and so LaRouche says that the breakthrough of Jesus, he being a Platonist and following Platonic strategies or style of reason.
Well, he was a Jew. I don't know that he even read Plato. We don't know that he read Plato.
Oh, yeah, the Philo of Alexandria translated Plato. I didn't know Jesus myself. I don't know.
One would assume that he studied Jewish mysticism.
Well, it was Greek culture. Hebrew and Greek was all over the place in the Middle East. And Jesus traveled for many years.
Mm.
So the point is that LaRouche says that he... understood. He definitely didn't go. LaRouche would say that Jewish mysticism is the wrong way to go, and Jesus was not a representative of Jewish mysticism, because that's Dionysian and Aristotelian. But the important point that LaRouche says Jesus made, the breakthrough he had coming out of the elite tradition of emphasizing reason, which LaRouche would define, it's not just like being reasonable. It means understanding the evolution, the determinant principles for universal man, universal humanity. The neat thing that LaRouche says is Jesus said that this knowledge is not for an elite. We must have compassion for the poor, for the uneducated. The doctrine of agape, or love. In other words, LaRue says that Jesus was very democratic and anti-elitist, and this is what the Platonists before him had not seen.
Right. He believed that God's love shines on all his children equally, and therefore
everybody should be a candidate to be developed. Probably, if you looked at sociology, you had to come out of certain better off families to be educated in the Greek era, and slaves were not included. So Jesus, he sort of democratized the Platonic curriculum to include everybody, which is interesting, interesting interpretation of Jesus in a secular way. You know what I mean? As a secular philosopher.
Sure.
So I'm going to go back and read this through a little more rapidly than you did. So he says, the Platonic method rightly distinguishes, remember the essay is called The Secrets Known, The Secrets Known Only to the Inner Elites. So he's saying that the Aristotelian elites move people away from Platonic understanding, and the Platonic understanding move people away from the Aristotelian. So there's the battle of the elites going on. So LaRouche is pro-Platonic method. And the Platonic method rightly distinguishes three qualities of knowledge, mental levels among people. The first, lowest condition of the human mind is the level of simple belief. Belief premised on popular mythologies and prejudices and on the state of ignorance concerning individual experience, otherwise known as common sense. And common sense is in quotes. So the Platonic method does not believe in what's going on around them. They don't believe. Like Krishnamurti, they're detached. I don't believe in anything, said Krishnamurti. They're not believing in the cultural bias. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So they have a kind of detachment, similar to McLuhan on a certain level, even though McLuhan might be tagged as a Aristotelian. But Hank Lou says the elites are, on both sides, are detached, just that they have different motives. The second, next higher level of knowledge is equivalent to the condition of understanding defined by Immanuel Kant, the mere understanding. Now, LaRouche thinks Kant isn't too good, but he's saying Kant is good for the second level, the mere understanding. It's kind of putting down Kant, because Kant wrote books with the title Understanding in them. So LaRouche is saying mere understanding. Persons at this level have consistent knowledge of the ostensibly lawful features of practice in certain various categories of human practice in general. I think it was Kant who came up with the categorical imperative. So they dealt with labels.
And he would have been a direct descendant of Aristotle.
Yeah, and so they dealt with, they believed their labels. They believed in the categories and the descriptions.
Mm-hmm.
They believed in sort of like an intellectual version of common sense. That, LaRouche says, would not lead to new breakthroughs, because you remain stuck in what is understood. You know more than the simple belief level, but you're still stuck in your categories.
Right. Now, was Aristotle a student of Plato?
A what?
Student of Plato.
Yes, yeah.
So there must have been some place where they were in agreement before Aristotle began to mutate the teaching.
Yeah, well, LaRouche says, and I don't think he could verify this, but it's interesting, he says Aristotle was an agent of Philip of Macedonia and was sent in to absorb the Plato stuff and then under the Platonic Academy and then undermine it.
Oh.
And they say that Aristotle assassinated Plato. No, assassinated Alexander the Great, who he was a teacher of.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
Don't think many people would agree with that. I don't. It's a supposition. LaRouche had written on it back in the 70s, sort of saying this is what points to that.
Mm-hmm.
That they thought that he was a real, you know, Dick Cheney kind of guy, Karl Rove kind of guy, as Karl Rove is presented in the media today.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this is a condition, okay, we're talking about the categorical understanding, the second level. This is a condition corresponding to the lowest level of what may be termed scientific knowledge. So it's scientific knowledge, but it's the lowest level. Such persons do not know why such categories exist or how or why the ostensibly lawful principles appropriate to such categories are determined. They have merely practical knowledge of consistent cause and effect features of practice in those categories of experience in which they have been educated.
Sounds like a college education to me.
Yes, and it's a visually biased. McLuhan would say, yes, simple visual categories, cause and effect, you know, your normal visual space stuff. Gutenberg galaxy stuff, right? You got that?
Yeah.
Are you still there?
Yes, I'm here.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, you were gone for a second. So you're saying that college education is the Kantian second level?
Sure, all the way up through graduate school.
Yeah. The third highest level of human knowledge is reason italicized, otherwise termed Plato's Socratic reason. It is only on this level that truth can be efficiently comprehended. The knowledge of the two lower levels is necessarily mythological, false, or as Spinoza specifies, fictitious. Fictitious in quotes. For such reasons, the Platonics judge mythologies twofoldly. In other words, there's going to be useful mythologies and false mythologies, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that can sound like, you know, your normal, almost in quotes, moral person who says, oh, it's not good the kids go this way. That'll lead to laziness and disarray and jail. Best to go the other way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the Platonists judge mythologies twofoldly.
They're kind of like dealing, you know, they're dealing with the masses or the, I don't know if you call them the public or whatever, but as children, right?
You tell
children stories
when
you want them to understand things that are a little too adult for them.
Yes. So all stories or mythologies they knew to be inherently false or fictitious, but no person could rise above mythologies except by attaining reason. So there's a way of rising above them. Therefore, in dealing with masses living at the inferior levels of mental life, it was deemed necessary to deal with them on the terms of mythological beliefs, you know, in their terms, which is the same way that McLuhan deals with media, on the terms of media. But he's looking at the structures, not necessarily the people in the structures.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at the structures on their own terms. But LaRouche is dealing with people. The issue of practical politics, therefore, took the task-oriented form of distinguishing among destructive and useful mythologies. Those forms of simple beliefs or mere understanding which tended to allow society to move in directions otherwise required by reason were deemed the tolerable class of mythologies. Reading that again. Those forms of simple beliefs or mere understanding which tended to allow society to move in directions otherwise required by reason were deemed the tolerable class of mythologies. In other words, if you had a society of reason, you'd move that way, and you would have to move that way.
Mm-hmm.
As he says above, the Platonists do it on the level for themselves. They know to go the way of reason. They don't get embedded in mythologies.
So he's got to convince me that a bunch of people on, you know, the four hemispheres of the globe who don't know each other and get together and practice the art of reason come to the same conclusions.
Yes, he's going to have to do that. So we got lots of quotes to move into that.
Mm-hmm.
Those other, I'm just laying out here his educational pedagogic agenda, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because we've spent, you know, first 10 pages going over his concepts. Now he's trying to tell us what one does with them once you have the good understanding of the way the mind works.
Right.
Okay, and remember, it's going towards more technologies and more population density. He's working towards potential population density. Okay, so those forms of simple beliefs or mere understanding which tended to allow society to move in directions otherwise required by reason were deemed the tolerable class of mythologies. Those other mythologies which tended toward evil consequences were evil beliefs which must be fought accordingly. And he says, it is impossible to understand the central doctrinal issues among leading Christian theologians from the apostolic period to present times without taking that Platonic view inclusively into account. In other words, the way they put on the local mythologies and move them one and promote one mythology versus another one. But all to move the person through the mythology, and if they stayed with them long enough, with the Platonists, they would move to the third level of not numbed or inside the ignorant mythology. They'd see something that was obvious, which LaRouche calls reason, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not obvious in the common sense way, but obvious in the direction you must push thought. These theologians have been concerned for themselves and for determination of policy with the issues of truth according to reason. So they did that for themselves, determined policy with the issues of truth according to reason. They have been at the same time otherwise concerned with popular mythologies respecting chiefly whether this or that popular belief led away from or toward the realization of the dictates of reason. And the dictates of reason wasn't like an abstract situation, so he's similar to McLuhan. He's not saying we go towards visual space, though LaRouche wouldn't use that term. But we've done enough, a little bit of McLuhan, to know what it means, that reason is looking at the invisible environment and where it's pointing to. Right? It's not something that, it's not an assumption. It's not the, mythologies are assumptions, LaRouche would say. But to move towards unfolding the invisible evolution of potential population density, there's a way to do that. Then he says, LaRouche says, although the objective has been to bring all of mankind into the state of reason, or atonement, for immediate purposes, the rule has been that this effort must be situated within terms of the problem defined by the simple beliefs of the ignorant. Now, if we're going to a lofty, more comprehensive situation, but in the meantime, we're stuck with ignorant assumptions all around us. The Aristotelians and their heirs, in other words, the bad guys, notably including Bernard of Clairvaux, and LaRouche went on to put down the Knights Templars. And so Bernard is a founder of the Knights Templars, so he's in the bad gang. The Aristotelians and their heirs, notably including Bernard of Clairvaux, Martin Luther, the guy who started the Protestant Church, and the Presbyterian leaders, had and continue an opposite policy concerning mythologies. So we can detect here a bit of a pro-Vatican, anti-Martin Luther Protestant bias here in LaRouche, right?
Yeah. Now, what was the... you threw out the term the Knights Templars. What do they represent here? They represent... They hold this idealistic vision, and they're going to go out with all their valor and courage, and they're going to defend this ideal of some kind. How are we contrasting the Knight Templar here with
Well, LaRouche says that the Venice around 1100 A.D. played off the sort of semi-developed European kingdoms, the Western kings, played off them against the Ottoman Empire. So they got the Western kings to send out knights on the Crusades to invade the Ottoman Empire, the Middle Eastern zone. So the Crusades was an evil movement propped up by the Venetian bankers, right? Venetian merchants, and the Knights Templars were very significant in the crusading years.
Because the popular belief of the Knights Templars were that they started the banking industry and that they. And that they were defenders of the Christ, and so they were the good guys.
Well, it depends on how you look at banking. They gathered and became very wealthy, and they were oligarchic. LaRouche said that they did not do trade to encourage technological growth. They did it to acquire wealth for themselves, like their puppeteers, the Venetians.
Yeah. So they might have had lofty goals in the beginning, but became corrupted by the wealth that they gathered along the way.
Yeah, probably LaRouche would say it was the imperialistic Vatican. See, LaRouche is not always for the Vatican. Through history, it changes. Sometimes it's taken over by the black nobility. So he sees the control of the Vatican and the whole Crusades enterprise as a colonizing, anti-reason enterprise. Okay, so let's, maybe we'll get some more quotes later on that. The Aristotelians and their heirs, notably including Bernard of Clairvaux, Martin Luther, and the Presbyterian leaders, had and continue an opposite policy concerning mythologies. The original Aristotelians were the intelligence services arm of the oligarchies, jointly controlling the court of Philip of Macedon, that's the time of Plato and Aristotle, and the contemporary Persian court of that time. So the intelligence services were playing Persia off against Athens and Macedonia, as Venice would do 1,000 years later.
Mm-hmm.
The objective, and this is modeled on, this is a historical isomorphic reflection of London in the 20th century, or the last 200 years. London is the Venice, the update of Venice, or the intelligence services playing off Macedonia and Persia, LaRouche would say that London played off Soviet Union against the United States in the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
It was an update of Venice. And that's what the oligarchies do.
Mm-hmm.
They get people bogged down in wars and stop technological progress, as he says here.
Mm-hmm.
So the original Aristotelians were the intelligence services arm of the oligarchies, jointly controlling the court of Philip of Macedon and the contemporary Persian court of that time. Their objectives were to stop technological and scientific progress and to create zero growth synthetic mythologies as the simple beliefs of the ignorant masses. In other words, they encouraged the growth of mythologies. They didn't try to make the masses move out of the mythology,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
These efforts they regarded as the means to establish permanent world rule by a landlord-based oligarchy, de-emphasizing cities in favor of the countryside, and maintaining Malthusian zero-growth, anti-technology policies against scientific progress. Now, LaRouche is writing this to counter the rock, sex, drugs, and rock and roll counterculture of the 60s, the Tim Leary, Alan Watts ideology that advocate people dropping out of the cities and going to the country. He said that was just Venetian ideology,
mm-hmm.
right? Anti-technology, Malthusian, zero growth, de-emphasizing cities.
Mm-hmm.
So he's taking an idea of not liking those dirty hippies and making a whole intellectual structure out of it, a historical thread to support his dislike of the counterculture, right?
Mm-hmm.
These efforts they regarded as the means to establish permanent world rule by a landlord-based oligarchy, de-emphasizing cities in favor of the countryside, and maintaining Malthusian zero-growth, anti-technology policies against scientific progress. They have not altered that method or purpose to the present day. The innermost belief of the leading Christian theologians with access to reason is typified by the outlook of the famous Abelard of the 11th century AD, where strict Aristotelians argued that God made himself impotent by creating inalterable laws for the universe, and hence only omniscient. Abelard defined the function of man's existence according to reason to be the helper of God in the continuing work of creation. Now, that is the idea of humans being a co-creator of the universe, and where the universe was not finished, it did not get ruled by laws that were unalterable. Therefore, the God was not impotent, hadn't finished, and was not just limited to being omniscient and knowing everything about all the categories. There was more to be known. And Abelard, who is in McLuhan land, Abelard represents the dialecticians, who McLuhan ostensibly countered with his own favoritism to the grammar rhetorician. So you have here LaRouche emphasizing the opposite of McLuhan.
Mm-hmm.
That's a simple definition of McLuhan. McLuhan was neither.
In what sense is he opposite of McLuhan here?
He's pro-Abelard,
mm-hmm.
whereas McLuhan ostensibly is anti-Abelard.
Mm-hmm.
But a more sophisticated understanding of McLuhan knows that McLuhan was neither dialectician, grammarian, nor rhetorician, though in general he seemed to be, in dealing with the mythologies of 20th century life, seemed to be anti-Abelard and pro-Bernard of Clairvaux.
Mm-hmm.
So Abelard, he had an idea that the universe was still unfolding, and that humans could be the helper of God in the continuing work of creation. Abelard located lawfulness in the lawfulness governing the ordering of continued creation,
mm-hmm.
not the lawfulness governing the ordering of finished creation, right?
Mm-hmm. I wonder if he believed that the laws of nature were still undergoing...
Who, LaRouche or Abelard?
Well, I guess either one of them.
Yeah.
If they believed that the laws of nature were still evolving, or if it was just that we had an evolving understanding of the laws of nature that we needed to continue to develop.
Well, both. He said that there are laws that we will eventually figure out and find are already there, but it's not a law that becomes a final law. The basic law is keep an open mind.
Mm-hmm.
Keep allowing new technologies, new inventions, encourage them.
Mm-hmm.
The other point you said was what? That they either said we will find the laws or... Yes, that nature was still evolving, and that humans were changing nature. LaRouche does state that.
Oh, that's interesting. That humans were changing the laws of nature?
Yeah.
Hmm. That's interesting. That means there's a really tight coupling between the human being and the laws of nature.
Yes. There's an essay done by a colleague called The Self-Development of the Biosphere in about 1975 in The Campaigner. It's a good essay.
Mm-hmm.
LaRouche considers that humans change nature. In other words, he's not making the...
They change nature working within the laws of nature, but I don't know that they change the laws of nature.
Well, the laws of nature are always being further and more completely understood.
Right.
So let's go into the next quote, and where he tries to describe how and what is the law of nature and how it unfolds, and do you actually find a lawfulness?
Okay.
He says the hypothesis of the higher hypothesis is discovering a lawfulness in the method of developing hypotheses,
mm-hmm.
which are breakthroughs. So he says the exact opposite position was classically argued by the 12th century Bernard of Clairvaux, a point of importance we shall cover in the course of this report. Now, the next quote is from the same essay. What we just went through is pages 12, 13, and 14 of The Secrets Known Only to the Inner Elites,
mm-hmm.
written in 1978. So we're now going to do another section, half as long, on answering some of Scott's questions about what are these laws and are they knowable? Are they? But the thing is that the idea that media were extensions of us and we're us is McLuhan's point. There's a slight overlap here. LaRouche is saying similar things. He's saying technology is nature, or he would say nature as we concretize it is not what one should regard, because if you concretize the aspects of nature like Aristotle did, you get stuck in categories.
Mm.
So we're still probing nature, is LaRouche's view.
Sure. But it's one hand washes the other. You have to concretize to make something, and then once you've made it, you can't say that that's the last word. You have to keep questioning it, seeing if you can break it down into more elemental constituents or whatever.
Or find bigger inclusive patterns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
No, you're right. And so, in a way, what stops knowledge? Well, ego, vanity, power. And so he's confronting power, and why do you stick to saying this is the way things
are?
Well,
it's like they say about physics. Physics evolves at the rate that the old physicists die off and the new physicists are able to move in, because the physicists who are pontificating today's physics are going to want to hold to what they believe is true. They don't have room for the new guys until they die off, and then the new guys come in and physics evolves.
Yeah, now LaRouche would say that happens in Aristotelian institutions.
Yeah.
And LaRouche cannot wait around for that. And so he goes outside of the academy and just starts trying to get an educated citizenry to move forward,
right,
and not get stuck in the academic world,
right. So before we move on, the one thing I wanted to ask about the third highest level of human knowledge, reason, otherwise termed Plato's Socratic reason.
Yeah.
How is Plato's Socratic reason different from Socrates' reason?
It'd be no different. But we are going to get some. There's a lot more quotes here because we need to fill out what we've said so far.
Okay.
So, I mean, yeah, there's a lot of stuff here.
So that'll get answered along the way.
Yeah, because there's a lot of assumptions and meanings aligned with the word, identified with the word reason, that he's going to break up and erase, so that in the end, reason becomes something that's not cliche,
mm-hmm.
and it becomes practical. Okay, so how much time do we have on this side?
Less than 5 minutes.
Okay, we have time to read the quote.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is page 59. We're going in my book, page 24, over to page 26, and it is page 59 of the essay, The Secrets Known Only to the Inner Elites, written in May, June 1978, or published in those months. So you want to go forward.
Again, the only aspect of human consciousness which is in correspondence with such a transfinite hyphen or transinvariant hyphen principle of the universe is the quality of progress in human scientific knowledge rather than any specific subsumed scientific knowledge as such. The adducing of that principle, in turn, provides the methodological principle for ordering thought to the effect of willfully, quote, energizing the progress of scientific knowledge. That is the method of rigorous hypothesis. That is the meaning of the dialectical method, the method of rigorously developing valid hypothesis. The method employed...
Valid hypotheses.
Hypotheses, plural.
Yeah.
The method employed is the Platonic method of italicized negation, as applied from the standpoint of the level of reason.
That's negation, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The method of negation means to isolate those axiomatic fallacies of existing knowledge, and parentheses understanding, which bear upon the crucial experimental problems confronting us. The qualitative elimination of the axiomatic fallacy permits the defining of experiments which can be represented in terms of qualitative relationships.
No, quantitative relationships.
Quantitative, yeah, it's a difference. The essential underlying test of the validity of a hypothesis, in parentheses here, as a hypothesis, posed in this way, is the test of whether the hypothesis, if successfully demonstrated, implies a means for increasing the negentropy of human practice. Such hypotheses, that's plural, are defined by Riemann as, quote, unique hypotheses, unquote. Their distinction, in effect, is that they test the laws of the universe for category of knowledge rather than merely testing the applicability of extension of established principles to a problem without involving...